Since 2011, American Giant has been making everyday clothing with extraordinary effort. Not in far-off factories, but right here in the USA. We obsess over fabrics, fit, and details, because if you're going to wear it every day, it should feel great and last for years. From the cut of a hoodie to the finishing of a seam, nothing is overlooked. Our supply chain is tight-knit and local, which means less crisscrossing the country and more care in every step. The result is durable clothing, t-shirts, hoodies, sweatpants, and denim that become part of your life season after season. This isn't fast fashion, it's clothing made with purpose by people who care as much about how it's made as how it fits. Get 20% off your first order with code STAPLE20 at American-Giant.com. That's 20% off your first order at American-Giant.com with code STAPLE20.
You are watching the Deadfoot Diver Podcast with Kurt the Deadfoot Diver.
Welcome to the Deadfoot Diver Podcast, where we talk about everything diving, tech diving, and especially the benefits of diving with disabilities. I am very pleased to have on a legend in the diving industry. She is former Navy Captain Bobby Scholey, who has done some amazing stuff. She is actually the fourth woman in the U.S. Navy history to command a surface vessel, which is very impressive. In 2000, she also is the first woman to command a mobile diving unit. She has served as the supervisor of diving for the Navy from 1997 to 1999, and she has been involved in some pretty amazing stuff. So how's it going, Bobby? Well, thank you very much for joining me today. It's amazing to meet you and talk about your diving. So tell me how you first got involved in diving, because you don't have a normal story.
No, I don't. There really aren't a lot of women who had the opportunities that I had and who have gotten into Navy diving. As a matter of fact, as you probably know, this year is the 50th anniversary of the first women who actually became Navy divers, which we're celebrating this year in a couple of weeks. And so although women have been Navy divers since 1975, it's still unusual. And I didn't start in 1975. I started my Navy diving career in 1983, which, you know, if you do the math, was a little while ago, makes me a little bit of an older diver. But I kind of stumbled into it. I never had a goal to become a Navy diver, and I actually never had a goal to join the Navy when I was growing up. I did have a childhood that revolved around the water, but I grew up in the Midwest. I grew up in central Illinois. So, you know, there's not a lot of diving in central Illinois. So, you wouldn't have thought that I would end up having the career that I end up having. But my father was in the Navy well before he became my father, before he even got married. So I knew a little bit about the Navy from just the stories that my dad talked about when I was growing up. And I grew up in a small town in central Illinois, actually called Normal, Illinois, which, you know, it's kind of a funny name. I had a normal childhood. Grew up with a, you know, Midwestern family, went to school, and went to college in my hometown, Illinois State University. So after I graduated from college with a degree in biology, you know, I wanted out of central Illinois. I wanted an adventure, you know. So what do you do with a degree in biology from your hometown. Well, obviously you join the Navy and see the world because you want the adventure, you know, just like they say in the recruiting posters, right? Join the Navy, see the world, have an adventure. Well, this is 1981. And when my father was in the Navy in the early 1950s, that's not the Navy that he wanted his 22-year-old for the adventure, right? So there was a little bit of, great feelings about his young daughter going out and, you know, being a sailor in the Navy. But it was not your father's Navy in 1981. And I was joining as an officer. And so after he talked to the recruiter and realized that things had changed, but still it was 1981. So it was not necessarily the opportunities for women that were broad and open. So I went through officer candidate school in Newport, Rhode Island. And I have to tell you, the first time I got in an airplane was when I got on a little puddle jumper and left Normal, Illinois to fly to Newport, Rhode Island to join the Navy. So that's where the adventure began, my first time on an airplane. And, you know, it just kept growing and growing. So I did get my commission into the Navy. And when I went through officer candidate school, it was a course. And there were 20 women in my class at officer candidate school. I don't remember, you know, the total size of the class, but there were 20 women. And we all went through together. And there was one position that the women, we had to choose when we graduated, where we were going to go for our first assignment. And we got to choose based on our rank standing, how well we did at officer candidate school. And I ended up as the second ranking woman in the class. And there was one position, one assignment to go to a ship. And so I thought, gosh, if I'm going to be in the Navy for the adventure, I might as well go to a Navy ship, right? You know, I want to do it right. So I was high enough in the ranking that I was able to choose the Navy ship. I had no idea what I was getting myself into, obviously, but heck, I'm 22 years old. Let's just go for broke. You know, I want to go on a ship. So my first assignment was to a submarine repair ship, the USS Canopus, out of Charleston, South Carolina. And I was going as the electrical officer. You know, had no background in electrical engineering or anything like that. But that's, you know, the Navy trains you. It sends you to the right school. I went to surface warfare school to learn about ships and learn about engineering and that sort of stuff. And arrived at my first ship as the electrical officer. It was a submarine repair ship. So, of course, we were dealing with submarines and repairs under the water line and that sort of stuff. And my first ship had a diving locker on board, which just fascinated me. And here was this group of Navy divers. Their job was to do all the work on the submarines below the waterline, like you would expect. And this was just really interesting to me. So I would, you know, spend some time kind of watching what they were doing when I had the chance, you know, around all the duties that I had. And there was a young woman that was part of the dive locker. She was a young petty officer. She was also an engineman. And her name was Terry Reese. I'll never forget her. I don't think I ever spoke to her once. I never met her, but I saw her working as a member of the, she was a diver, as a member of the dive team. It looked like she was fully integrated, and everything I heard about her was very good, that, you know, she was a good diver, she was a good engineman. And it suddenly dawned on me, oh my gosh, women can be divers in the Navy? Really? So I found out, you know, in the course of the first assignment I had in the Navy, one, I can be on a Navy ship. I can drive Navy ships. out into the middle of the ocean, and women can be Navy divers. So this is in the early 1980s when they had just made some changes to the military with, you know, some of the new legislation where they were opening up new career opportunities for women in these non-traditional roles, which included shipboard assignments and Navy diving and a few other Navy explosive ordnance disposals. And so I just entered the Navy at this beginning of this new era for women where there were new opportunities. And I stumbled into that at just the right time. Although Donna Tobias, who's the first woman to go to Navy dive school in 1975, she was the first one, you know, back then. At that time, women weren't allowed on ships. So Donna Tobias went through dive school, and then she went to a shore assignment. She actually ended up going to Groton, Connecticut, and became an instructor at the submarine escape rescue chamber up in Groton, Connecticut. She never got to go to a ship. She stayed in the Navy for, I think, 6 or 7 years. It wasn't until 1979, when legislation was changed, that women could start going to auxiliary ships, like the repair ships or the tenders or the diving ships. So I got to my ship in 1981, right at the very beginning. So here we go. Bobby sees that women can become divers. Well, how do I do that? I got lucky. I was assigned for 3 years on the Canopus, and the policy was you do 18 months in one job on the ship, and then 18 months in a second job on the ship. The diving officer had retired, and there wasn't anybody else with orders to come in and to take that job. So I was able to convince my chain of command, the executive officer and the captain, to send me to dive school, and then I'd come back and fill that job. That's kind of a simplification of what happened. I had to get in shape. I had to work out a lot so that I could pass the qualification requirements in order to get into dive school, which, by the way, are the exact same qualifications for men and women. There were no double standards. I had to do the exact same number of pull-ups, push-ups, sit-ups, the same run, the same swim as the dudes. There are no double standards there. Women and men did the exact same thing in order to get accepted into dive school. So, you know, a lot of running, a lot of push-ups, a lot of pull-ups, because for my generation, girls didn't do pull-ups in high school. I mean, you know, this was before your time, but girls did the bent arm hang in high school, which is a ridiculous exercise. And, you know, but anyway, I managed to pull that off and, went to dive school in 1983, came back, and my first job as a diving officer was on board the USS Canopus.
Wow, that's really cool. Now, I mean, the other strange thing that I heard of, which makes this story even more amazing, was before you went to dive school, apparently you had never even gone snorkeling. Is that true?
Oh, no. Well, I grew up in Central Illinois. You don't snorkel in the Illinois River. There's nothing to see. It's, you know, it's all brown water. No. No. And you know what? When I got to dive school, the instructors said it's actually better to get students who have never scuba dived or done any of that sort of stuff, because then they can take us from scratch and teach us the way the Navy does business. And then we don't have to unlearn any of the stuff that, you know, nothing against NAWI or PADI or any of the other civilian training programs, but the Navy does things slightly different. So then we didn't have to unlearn anything that we knew before. But I do have to tell you, I had a really hard time learning how to breathe through my mouth and not my nose when I went through the scuba phase, you know, because I kept trying to breathe through my nose and, you know, that doesn't work in scuba. But then when we did hard hat, it wasn't an issue. But, you know, we started out with scuba before we went through the hard hat training. So, yeah, that took me a few days to learn not to breathe through my nose.
So was that the worst thing you found about scuba diving, was not breathing through your nose when you started?
Oh, no. Well, I grew up in Central Illinois. You don't snorkel in the Illinois River. There's nothing to see. It's, you know, it's all brown water. No. No. And you know what? When I got to dive school, the instructors said it's actually better to get students who have never scuba dived or done any of that sort of stuff, because then they can take us from scratch and teach us the way the Navy does business. And then we don't have to unlearn any of the stuff that, you know, nothing against NAWI or PADI or any of the other civilian training programs, but the Navy does things slightly different. So then we didn't have to unlearn anything that we knew before. But I do have to tell you, I had a really hard time learning how to breathe through my mouth and not my nose when I went through the scuba phase, you know, because I kept trying to breathe through my nose and, you know, that doesn't work in scuba. But then when we did hard hat, it wasn't an issue. But, you know, we started out with scuba before we went through the hard hat training. So, yeah, that took me a few days to learn not to breathe through my nose.
So was that the worst thing you found about scuba diving, was not breathing through your nose when you started?
Yes, that was. Otherwise, I loved it. I just absolutely loved it. It was, you know, I won't say it came naturally to me because, you know, there were a few things, but, you know, it was just like a whole new world that just opened up to me that I thought, where have I been all these years, all these 22 years, or at that point, 23 years of my life, because, you know, I just couldn't believe that I had been missing out on this. It was, you know, it was the best thing. I have to say, you know, dive school was hard, don't get me wrong, both physically and mentally challenging, because we had a lot of in classroom stuff that we had to do, which we all know as divers, you know, it's not just about the physical stuff. It's a lot of mental stuff. It's a lot of education that goes into it to be safe divers, especially as leaders. And so it was very challenging, probably the most challenging thing that I school that I went through in the Navy. But it was the best, you know, thing that I ever went through, and absolutely, you know, the best turning point in my life is when I went through Navy dive school and became a Navy diver.
That's really cool. I mean, did you find back then, because it was so early, what was the attitude like with the guys towards the women diving?
You know, that was really scary at first when I showed up at dive school, because, you know, I was worried about that. And I remember arriving at dive school and worrying about my classmates. But for the most part, my classmates were very supportive. And my leading instructor at the school, which was who was a chief, pulled myself, and there was one other woman in my class, which was kind of unusual, Karen Lynn, and she and I are, you know, best friends even today. He pulled the two of us aside right off the bat, like day one, and he told us, you know, if anybody gives you a hard time because you're women and, you know, tries to tell you that you know, you shouldn't be here, or we're going to give you a hard time because you're women, blah, blah, blah. He said, you let me know immediately. He said, because I'm not going to put up with that. You know, nobody's going to, you know, I'm just not going to put up with that. He said, on the other hand, you're going to get a hard time because your students, and this is dive school, and all the students are, you know, get a hard time from the instructors because that's part of what we do here. And he said, and we're not going to go easy on you because you're women. So, you know, I'm going to give you a hard time because that's what happens here. And don't expect to be given any breaks because you're women or anything like that. And we're like, well, you know, of course, Chief, we wouldn't expect anything less. We want to be, you know, given the same hard time as the guys. So he was very upfront from the very beginning. You're not going to, you know, don't take any crap because you're women, but you're going to get a lot of crap because you're a student. And that's what happens here. And so it was all very cut and dry. There were, you know, obviously there were some guys, both students and instructors, who, you know, still didn't think women belonged as divers or in the Navy. But they kept it to themselves, and nobody threw it in our face. And I have to say that that's the beauty of becoming a Navy diver and being in a small elite community like the Navy diving community, because once you've proven yourself, excuse me, and you've qualified, you've made it through dive school, you put that pin on, and then you've built your reputation in the community, that reputation follows you throughout your career. And you become part of the team, part of the family, and you don't have to keep proving yourself over and over. I mean, you're part of the community, you're part of a small knit group, and you become just part of the family. So throughout my 24-year career in the Navy, I didn't have to keep, you know, proving that women can do this and this. Every once in a while, I'd run across somebody who still thought, oh, women don't belong in the Navy, they don't belong in the diving community. But it was so rare because, you know, I already had a reputation within the community, and there were enough people in the community who would say, you know, no. Captain Scully has already, you know, she's already proven that she's part of the team, and, you know, that's ridiculous. I would run into problems with people outside of the community who, you know, still had some issues with women in the Navy. But once you've gotten, became a part of the team in the dive community, you were solid.
That's cool. So how long did they have you on scuba before you progressed to surface supply?
4 weeks. If I remember correctly, I think scuba was the first 4 weeks of school.
And then was pretty well most of the stuff you did after that, most of it on surface supply?
Yes, it was. A whole variety of surface supplied. Some of that old surface supplied stuff. I don't know if you've ever seen the Jack Brown. There was a full face mask. I mean, I'm really aging myself here, but the Jack Brown, my least favorite rig. I could never get it to seal because it just didn't fit my face. It was a great rig for out in the fleet because it was so simple. And, you know, especially for underwater ship's husbandry, you know, just working on a ship, but I could never get it to seal. So it would just leak right until it was, you know, full of water. And anyway, I didn't like it. I love the Navy's Mark 12, which was the square helmet. And anyway, I just loved it. It was like having, you know, a fishbowl on your head. But yeah, surface supplied is my thing. Unfortunately, after I retired, that's it. You know, no more surface supplied, but that was my favorite. Yes, it would. I'd have to have the whole team, and you know, wasn't cost effective. Yes, it would. I'd have to have the whole team, and you know, wasn't cost effective.
Have you done much rebreather diving or anything like that?
I have not, no. And I have lots of friends. I'm sure you know I'm a member of the Women Divers Hall of Fame, and lots of my sisters in the Women Divers Hall of Fame who are, you know, tech divers, who keep saying, "Bobby, come out and tech dive with me." And I say, "No, you guys are crazy. I am not going tech diving with you and hanging on a line and doing all that decompression stops on a line. I do decompression in a chamber. That's where I do my decompression, not hanging on a line in the middle of the ocean with extra tanks on my back. That's just craziness." You know, I give you guys a lot of credit. You guys are, you know, I bow down to you guys doing all that crazy stuff, hanging on a line in the middle of the ocean. Not me. No, give me a chamber, please. And her cave diving, I almost can't watch her videos when she does that that amazing cave diving stuff. That just freaks me out. You know, I've done some scary stuff, but not scary stuff like Jill does. She is just incredible. I just give her so much.
She is. She does an insane amount of stuff. It's been incredible, the stuff that she's actually done. And I mean, I think back in the 90s when I first was diving and was a professional, I would do some riskier stuff back then, but I wouldn't have even thought of attempting half the stuff that she does.
And she's so meticulous, and she's so safe, and she just, you know, she's saving the planet and doing all sorts of stuff, and I give her so much credit.
Tech diving definitely takes a different type of attitude and a lot of training. I actually, when I got back into diving this year, I was like, okay, I'm going to get into doing some tech diving again, because I was just getting into that when I got out of it. I got side mount trained this year, which I love diving side mount. It's way easier, especially with my disabilities with my leg and stuff. Shore diving still sucks. Cause up where we are, it's all rock. So it's not fun getting in out of the water. Once I'm in, I'm okay. But yeah. And I was actually thinking about doing some cave stuff, but I've decided to tone down on that bit, and there ain't no way you're getting me into a cave.
Yeah. Oh, wow. No, I'm with you. Diving over the side of a boat or a ship, that's the way to go.
So let's talk about some of the other cool stuff you've done, because, I mean, you've done some pretty cool salvage operations. I mean, you're involved in the TWA Flight 800 recovery, the USS Cole bombing attack after that, and also the USS Monitor. So tell me, how did you get involved in these, and what did you do, for instance, on the TWA Flight 800?
You know, it's Navy diving is has several different aspects of it. We call ourselves fleet divers, diving, salvage, and fleet divers, because there's so many different types of divers in the Navy. We have, you know, the SEALs. They're the guys that, you know, the sneaky, spooky, scary guys. And my husband was a SEAL, and I just tease him that he's the shallow water divers. You know, they just dive shallow, and, you know. And then we have the explosive ordnance disposal divers, who are incredible. You know, the things that they do with and the things that they did during the global war on terrorism, and continue to do. And I give them great respect, because they're using the rebreathers and that sort of stuff. And the CB divers, and then the fleet divers, the diving and salvage divers like myself, we do ships repairs, underwater ships husbandry, and then deep ocean salvage is one of the big things that we do. And missions where I was involved in those operations that you talked about. I had just left my ship command. You mentioned that I was the CO of a diving and salvage ship. And I did three ship tours back to back. So I was at sea for 7 years and finally finished my ship command in 1994 and was going to shore duty finally, you know, so I could spend some time with my husband, and went to a shore command to be the diving and salvage staff officer on an admiral staff. And we were in charge of the two diving ships and a bunch of other auxiliary ships out of Norfolk, Virginia. And then in the summer of 1996, in June, TWA Flight 800 out of JFK Airport in New York exploded right after takeoff and fell out of the air into the water just south of Long Island, New York, with, you know, all hands, obviously, all the passengers and everything. And so the Navy has an agreement with the National Transportation Safety Board that when an accident happens and it goes into the water, then the Navy will come and assist them with the investigation, which means recovering what they can of what the accident is. So our job in the Navy was to mobilize assets quickly to go up and try to recover. At first, it was a search and rescue mission that the Coast Guard handles, and the Coast Guard was right there trying to recover any passengers, which turned out that there was nobody that survived. And then it becomes a search mission and recovery of the aircraft for the investigation. And that's where the Navy comes in. So we immediately sent a ship up there, a salvage ship, to start helping with the search. Because, you know, people think that an airplane falls out of the sky and it falls out of the sky in one piece, like in the movies, and it's just sitting on the bottom of the ocean in one piece, and we know exactly where it is, and we just go and we pick it up and we take it, you know, to the shore. And while that, you know, divers know that shipwrecks and aircraft wrecks don't happen that way. They fall apart and you don't know where they are because the ocean is a big place. So the first thing you had to do was send ships up with side-scan sonar and other sonar equipment to start searching for where the aircraft was. And the aircraft split up into three pieces, and it was a huge debris field. And we didn't know exactly because it fell from height, and we didn't know exactly where it was on the ocean floor. And so that took a while. But it turned into such a big, high-visibility operation that my boss, the admiral, was ordered by the fleet to take command of the whole operation and move up to Long Island and become the officer in charge. And my boss, Admiral Christensen, who was a fabulous guy, was not a diver, was not a salvage officer. So, of course, my job was to go with him as his subject matter expert. So we ended up in Long Island at the Coast Guard station for the next 4 months doing the operation, the salvage and recovery operation, to recover about 99% of that 747 aircraft, which is a huge aircraft. Working with the National Transportation Safety Board, the FBI, a lot of law enforcement in the state of New York to do this very high visibility recovery and salvage operation. It was, I say it was only in 120 feet of water, but, you know, 120 feet is kind of just at the limit of safe scuba diving. And with a debris field, you know, of that much airplane debris, we used a lot of surface supplied diving operations. So we ended up having two diving and salvage ships, so we could use surface supplied diving. We also used a lot of scuba with both Navy scuba and also local law enforcement divers were involved. So it was a huge operation, absolutely huge. We had hundreds of divers involved daily. starting in July and going through as long as we could until the weather got bad for us. And my role was as a senior leader doing the organization and oversight and that kind of stuff. I did make a couple dives. I didn't do that much diving, but basically a couple dives so that I could do a better job of advising the admiral who was in charge of the operation, to let him know what was real, you know, what it was like going down there. And I have to tell you, the diving on that's rough diving. And it's rough on the divers to do that kind of stuff because a lot of victim recovery and aircraft explosions are not pleasant victim recovery operations.
No, they're not. I've actually taken training with the police on underwater recovery and stuff back in the 90s. And part of it was doing plane crash stuff. And it's definitely not nice. I mean, how do you mentally prepare for something like that when you're going to do a dive like that?
It's hard. And that's one of the jobs that we typically do as salvage divers. It's usually a lot smaller scale. It's like if a military aircraft goes down, like a military helicopter, we might lose in the ocean, or a military aircraft that maybe doesn't make it during a carrier landing or something like that. Those are the types of things that we are more used to. Not a huge scale of a 747. So it's something that is part of our, our operations on a more routine basis. But a 747, and we're dealing with non-military victims, is a whole different level of, uncomfortableness. And so we really did have to, that was another part of the aspect of what the admiral and his staff, including us, we had to be concerned about is the effects on our divers, because they were doing diving day after day after day and recovering not only all of the salvage of the aircraft, which was a lot of twisted metal and wire and all that kind of stuff, which is not safe diving. It's very dangerous diving. But then also recovering the victims, and not just the victims themselves, but a lot of their personal effects, which is also hard on the divers. So we had to make sure that we had moral support for the divers during this. And divers don't like to admit that it's hard on them.
That's rough diving.
Exactly. And this was back in 1996, and nobody has cell phones back then. So it's not like they're picking up their cell phones and calling home and,
You can't I never even thought about that aspect. You couldn't even call up your buddy and go, oh man, you're not going to believe what I just did or whatever.
No.
Yeah. That would make it even worse. So, all right, I've got a couple of questions about the Monitor now. Tell me about your expedition on the USS Monitor, because this is one of the most famous shipwrecks in the world.
Yeah, so, we go from TWA Flight 800, which is, that's our mission. We're like the firemen, and you guys know, you've trained, with law enforcement, divers, we're like firemen when something goes wrong, or law enforcement, when something goes wrong, you call the Navy divers to go, you bring them in and they handle, first responder stuff. So TWA Flight 800, that's what we do. The USS, that's what we do. We have a bombing, we bring the divers in to help with that. And then we have something like Monitor. And that's like, wow, that's like giving us a reward for, TWA Flight 800 or Cole or Swiss Air or something like that. Wow, this is wonderful. So we worked with NOAA, the National Oceanographic and Atmospheric Administration, because Monitor, which is the very first National Marine Sanctuary, and it's a Navy asset, Monitor was a Navy vessel that we lost when it sank off the coast of Cape Hatteras in 1862. Okay, I should know this off the top of my head, but sometimes I forget. But it had been lost for years and years until it was rediscovered in 1974 by some researchers from Duke University and some other guys. And it's in 240 feet off the coast of Cape Hatteras. Not an easy dive, although, you know, some of the tech divers do that. But it's, you know, in the Gulf Stream. So it's, you know, again, it's not, and it's hurricane areas and that kind of stuff. But NOAA found it, and it's starting to it's starting to deteriorate because of the Gulf Stream and that sort of stuff. So we need to do some things. There's some artifacts that are very important to the monitor, and it needs to be stabilized. And so NOAA wants to do some work on it and bring some stuff back. So who do they turn to that are the experts in deep ocean salvage? The Navy. So they start working with the Navy, and they start talking to our supervisor of diving and salvage up in Washington, D.C. And they put together a plan, and they want to do some work on the monitor, but it's going to be a huge project, and it's going to take a lot of money. And how do they pull this all together? And they talk to some smart guys at the Navy, one of them being Captain Chris Murray, a good friend of mine, who at this time is at in Washington at the Naval Sea Systems Command in the job that I used to have, the supervisor of diving. And Chris works with John Broadwater, who's the director of the Monitor National Marine Sanctuary. And they put a plan together, and they go to Congress and they brief this plan to get money through a special fund called I can't think of what it's called. But anyway, it's a special plan, the Department of Defense funding, that is designed to help fund projects for training for military members. So we get this funding that will allow us to do this project that will not only help bring back artifacts from the monitor, but provides this excellent training for Navy divers, because this is deep ocean salvage, real deep ocean salvage at a huge scale, similar to what we did in 1996 on TWA Flight 800, but much deeper. So we're using not regular surface supplied and scuba. Now we have to use a much more complex systems. We need to use mixed gas surface supplied. And if we really want to do this right, we need to use saturation diving, which is something the Navy has, but not in a system that can be used in this application. We need a mobile saturation system, which the Navy didn't have at this time. So we need to try to use a commercial system that has been modified to Navy standards. And we have saturation divers in the Navy, of course. But we need to see if we can take a commercial system, modify it to Navy standards, and then use it in this application so that we have enough time enough bottom time for our Navy divers to actually do the work that needs to be done to accomplish this mission, and also use normal Navy surface supplied diving, but mixed gas. And we use helium and oxygen when we do mixed gas diving, unlike, the technical divers who use nitrox. We use heliox. So we plan this all out over a course of 3 years, from 2000 to 2002, in the summer months, because that's when the weather is good enough for us to dive off of Cape Hatteras, in that window between the winter storms and hurricane season. So we only have like 45 days that we can do this, and it has to be planned out very specifically. And it just so happened that I was, again, in the right place at the right time. I had fortunately gotten command at Mobile Diving and Salvage Unit 2 in 2000. And that was the command that was in the place to be in charge of Monitor Expedition 2001 and 2002. And although some of my buddies who wanted to be in charge of Monitor 2001 and 2002 were cursing my name, because it just worked out that Bobby Scully got to be the CO of Mudsu 2 during those two summers. So that's how I got to be in charge of Monitor 2001 and 2002. Just the luck of the draw, you know? I'm sorry. It just happened that way.
It would drive some of the guys nuts, though, especially on that one. It would drive anybody nuts, period. I mean,
it really did.
And what all did you guys bring up?
Really did. In 2001, we brought up the iconic steam engine of Monitor, which was the first horizontal side lever steam engine that allowed Monitor. And you can see, I have my Monitor painting. That's the Monitor off the coast of Cape Hatteras. It's really tiny, you can't see it. But Monitor was a unique design, the first of its class. And the steam engine was designed horizontally so that it allowed the engine room to be below the water line. And that was unique in allowing it to be protected then. Which allowed for the unique design of Monitor. So in 2001, we were able to recover the steam engine. And then in 2002, we really were able to recover the crown jewel of the Monitor, which was the revolving gun turret, which was so critical in the Battle of Hampton Roads, which was the battle between the Monitor and the Merrimack. But more importantly, changed the way the U.S. Navy did modern warfare by having a revolving gun turret, which allowed the ship to go into battle without having the ship having to maneuver every time it needed to change the position of the guns. Like in the old, you know, naval battles, the ship had to maneuver to get the guns pointed in the right direction. But now with Monitor, the gun turret would rotate so it could change the direction that the guns were pointing without having to change the ship's heading every time it had to change the gun's direction. So it was revolutionary for gun warfare, or for naval warfare. So, and Monitor being the first ship of its class, and bringing that gun turret back was, you know, very significant. And so we brought those both back in 2001, 2002. They've been turned over to the museum in Newport News, Virginia, the Mariner's Museum. They're still being conserved because they were in salt water for 140 years. And so it takes a long time to conserve them before they can be put on display in the museum. But you can watch the conservation process that's being done right there at the museum. It's incredible. So the museum is, but the museum has a whole center for the Monitor. So you can see all that being done and the whole process and the whole thing. But it was in 240 feet that we had to go down, and it's still a national marine sanctuary, which people know it still runs diving charters down there. It's a beautiful dive. I mean, I've made 19 dives on Monitor myself in hard hat, surface applied hard hat. But it's an incredible dive. The sanctuary is beautiful. But it was hard work to do it so that we wouldn't ruin the sanctuary. So we had to do surgical salvage to remove the steam engine and the turret, because the ship, when it sank, it flipped over upside down. And so it was on top of the turret and then the steam engine. So we had to, you know, very precisely cut away to get to the turret and that kind of stuff. So it took every one of those 45 days with saturation divers and surface applied mixed gas divers to get that all done before hurricane season hit. And, you know, it was quite a process. But we trained so many Navy divers in deep ocean salvage during the course of that it was an incredible operation.
Yeah, that would be amazing to dive on. I've actually talked to Gary Gentile, the guy who sued the U.S. government to be able to dive it.
Yes, yes. I've heard all about that. And, you know, I've met several people, Kathy Weidig and Joel Silverstein, who were part of those early expeditions out there. And, you know, I know of several people who continue to try, you know, to get out there. And, you know, I haven't read the book from Gary Gentile, but yeah, I've heard all those stories and, you know, all that stuff.
So let's talk a bit about your Woman Divers Hall of Fame and how you got involved in it and what you're doing for the 50th anniversary of it.
Well, I was actually inducted into the Women Divers Hall of Fame in 2000, the first year that it started. Although I wasn't able to get involved until I retired from the Navy. I just, you know, had too much other stuff going on. But once I retired, I got very active in the Women Divers Hall of Fame because although it's an organization that, you know, recognizes women who have excelled in their field of diving, you know, like Jill and like so many others. I mean, there's so many women who have done incredible things in diving who I knew nothing about when I was in the Navy. I didn't know that there were so many women out there doing this amazing stuff in diving. And once I got involved in Women Divers Hall of Fame and met these women, I was just thrilled. And now I have all these diving sisters that I didn't know that I've gotten to know over the last 20 years that I'm just, you know, so thrilled to be a part of this organization because these women are doing such fabulous stuff. And Women Divers Hall of Fame do this mentoring program that I've become a part of that I love because we are trying to grow the next generation of divers, women and men, with our scholarship program. And we have so many scholarships and training grants available. And right now they're open until October 31st. So if anybody is interested, there's still, our applications are still open and they can go to our website, which is, and look at our scholarships and training grants, because that's what we are passionate about, is giving back to the next generation of divers that are going to do incredible things. And we want to mentor these. And one of the things that I have been doing the last couple of years, because I'm also passionate about veterans, and we have been working with the National Park Services on a veterans program for disabled veterans, where we go out, and it's kind of women disabled veterans, but we take groups of women disabled veterans with the National Park Services and other nonprofits like the WAVES program, who have certified these disabled women veterans. They do all veterans. They certify them as scuba divers. And then we take these certified women veterans and we put them to work with the National Park Services, cleaning up these underwater national parks. And I went, it's been 3 years that I got to go. And so as Navy women divers, we're the mentors that go with them on these projects. And it's a 1 week project. And we go, like the one I went on was in Biscayne Bay. And we go for a week and we clean the garbage off of these national parks, off the reefs. And the week I went, we pulled up like, I don't know, 5,000 pounds of garbage off the reefs in Biscayne Bay. And we just go out and we in scuba and we go out and make two dives a day. And it's an all-women's veteran group. And then we get a dive boat from the local dive shop. And it's, you know, with a woman captain and a woman first mate. It's an all-woman thing. And women, you know, disabled veterans, and the Park Service staff are all women. So, sorry, Kurt, it's an all-woman thing. And
I got half of it. I'm disabled, but I'm not a woman.
And but the National Park Service does it with guys too. But this just the one that that Women Divers Hall of Fame is part of is just a women's group, and they just do a couple all women's group. But the National Park Service does it all year round with disabled veterans in other parks. It was the most awesome experience I've had in years going out with these women veterans who were all a lot younger than I was. And I hadn't been scuba diving in a lot of years. So it was the first time I'd gotten in the water for quite some time, because I went to the dive shop and I had to rent gear, and they gave me a BC with a dive computer on it. It's like, I've never used a dive computer. What's this all about? They looked at me like, wow, you're a really old lady. You've never used a dive computer. I'm like, no, I've never used a dive computer. Somebody show me how to use this thing. That's how old I am. But it was a blast. And we had a great time, and we were out on a dive boat, and we were all being, you know, a bunch of veterans, rowdy veterans. And I had to clean up my language when I got back home, because I have daughters, you know, and it's like, got to clean up my language again. And I'm back home. I'm not back in the military. It was so much fun. But we cleaned up so much trash off of the reefs there in Biscayne Bay. And we couldn't do it this past summer because of, you know, government budget cuts and stuff. But hopefully we'll get back to it, you know, next summer or the summer after that. But it's good. These veterans got so much out of it. And, you know, as you well know, diving is so good no matter what the disability is, whether it's one you can see or one that you can't see. Diving is absolutely wonderful for these veterans.
Absolutely. A million percent has changed my life more than I ever imagined getting back into diving again. So it's, yeah. I mean, that's the big reason I promote this with disabled diving. So I'm actually hoping to get my instructors again so that I can actually do scuba therapy with people's disabilities in the pool and stuff like that. So just because of the benefits of it.
Yeah. Well, like I mentioned to you, you need to check out our training grids also. Can I just make a pitch for our 50th anniversary of Women Navy Divers? So, you know, I mentioned Donna Tobias, dive school in 1975 as the first woman. She's unfortunately no longer with us. She passed away several years ago. Fought depression for many, many years and died of suicide, which, you know, is so sad. Another thing that we need to fight with veterans. But we're celebrating the 50th this year at DEMA, which is coming up in 3 weeks. And we're celebrating women in Navy diving, but really women in diving. And we're having a big event, and DEMA is holding an exhibit for us. We've had so many people who have come out to help support us and given us so much and been sponsors for us and helping us to just celebrate this milestone, a half a century of women in Navy diving. And this all kind of came about because last March, which is the March is Women's History Month, and normally the military, you know, promotes stuff for Women's History Month, And this year, of course, that didn't happen. And so I realized that that didn't happen. And I said, well, you know, if the military, you know, isn't going to recognize and celebrate Women's History Month and women divers, then we're going to do it ourselves, because veterans can do it ourselves. So we started doing that, and we got a lot of support from a lot of outside organizations, veterans and non-veterans, like the Journal of Diving History and those kind of organizations. The diving community came and supported us. And one thing led to another. And then DEMA said, hey, we'll give you an exhibit at DEMA. And so we have this huge, big exhibit that DEMA is providing to us in 3 weeks down in Orlando. And we said, well, then we're going to have a reunion, and we're going to try to, you know, find as many women divers as we can on social media, which is hard because we didn't have a list of names. We didn't have, you know, emails or any of that kind of stuff. So we started, you know, finding as many as we could, and we couldn't go to the military to ask for lists, you know, so it was hard. And we just tried to do it through social media. So we're missing a lot of names that we'd like to have. So I'm reaching out to all your viewers. If you know any women Navy divers that haven't heard, please tell them. We still want them to come to this reunion dinner or to DEMA for this big celebration. And so if they have any questions, they can go to our website, which is www.awnd.net for information about our celebration and our reunion. Our dinner, reunion dinner, is open to anybody who wants to help us celebrate. It's not just it's not just Navy divers. It's anybody who wants us to celebrate. And a lot of people in the diving community have come out to support us. Kirby Morgan, who provides all of our helmets. Deep, who you know, are doing the deep ocean exploration, and again, the history and diving, or the history of diving society, and those kind of folks. But you know, if other people won't support us, then we just, as veterans, we just take it upon ourselves to do these things. And 50 years is a half a century is a long time. It went by fast.
That is. How many women divers are there in the Navy, roughly? Or have there been, like, total? Do you have any rough count?
By our rough count, we think over the last 50 years, there may have been approximately 300 women who graduated from Navy Dive School. So that's not that many. It looks like women have been approximately 2% of the diving community, and it hasn't changed significantly over the past 50 years. And that kind of makes me sad, but I wish it has grown, but it hasn't decreased. So that gives me hope. But again, there's no double standard. I mean, women have to pass the exact same standards as men to qualify to go to school, and to pass the same standards as men in any of the Navy dive schools, whether it's salvage divers like myself, divers, EOD divers, CB divers, which are the underwater construction divers. We have women in the medical diving community, civil engineering corps, engineering duty officers. Women are currently still eligible to go into SEALs. We have not had a woman yet who has gone into the SEAL community, but as of now, they're still eligible. I don't, you know, that could change. Who knows? But but the standards are still the same. And I just saw a memo that came out like last week, based on the changes to or the push towards military fitness. And in the Navy, the three what they're considering combat rank ratings in the Navy, or the combat ratings in the Navy for military fitness purposes, include SEALs, EOD, explosive ordnance disposal, Navy divers, and SWCC, which is special warfare combat craft. Navy divers are considered combatant or combat for military fitness purposes, which has been the case, you know, all the way back to the 1980s when I went through Navy dive school. So nothing has changed, really. We've always had the same military fitness requirements, whether you're a man or a woman. So it's no change since when I went through dive school. So I don't see a difference from the new policy.
Hopefully this will bring some more awareness to your cause. And I will definitely have all the links down below for everybody to take a look at. So I just want to thank everybody for checking out the podcast today. And thank you again, Bobby, for coming on and having an interview with me. And I will talk to you next time on the Deadfoot Diver podcast.